Hi, this is LGBTQ&A, where we get to know different members of the LGBTQ community. I'm Jeffrey Masters, and I'm here today with Bambi Salcedo. Bambi is a legendary activist in our community and currently leads the Trans Latino Coalition. Stay tuned. Hey, Bambi.
Hey, Jeffrey, how are you?
Good. Welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for inviting me and for the opportunity to address the audience.
Oh, absolutely. I'm so excited to talk to you. You know, when I first saw you, you had long shoulder-length hair.
Yes, I did a couple of years ago.
Oh, it's been that long.
It's going to be 2 years in June of next year. So it's a year and a half ago since I decided to chop off my hair.
Yeah, like all of it. I love it. It looks amazing.
Yeah.
What made you decide to cut it?
It was really, I actually did it during a speech in Seattle at Trans Pride. So there was about 5,000 people there.
And
wow. Yeah, I did it, you know, publicly, and really it was part of my message. And my message was that nobody can dictate what we can do with our bodies but ourselves. And I offer my beautiful hair as a sign that I could do whatever I wanted with my body.
Wow. And that's, like, to the general population? Is that, like just, like, beauty standards and, like, gender norms and everything?
Well, even within the trans community, I mean, I was, like, you know, I got a lot of compliments, but also, like, people were shocked. Because, you know, for many of us, that's part of our femininity,
mm-hmm.
right? And so for me to, like, go from one stream to the next stream or to the other side, it was, like, you know, pretty radical, per se.
Yeah. That's a big, too, like, a message saying, like, physical obviously matters to a lot of people, but, like, it's what's inside. Like, your hair will not affect your gender either way.
Exactly. And that was totally the message. That was totally... you know, and it was also liberating, you know, because it's like you're basically not conforming, right?
Yeah.
To what society tells you that you are supposed to be, but you're simply being yourself.
On a practical level, is it easier to deal with now, your hair?
Oh, totally. I mean, even when I had, like, long hair, I usually used to have it, like, on a bun. It was just easier for me to just grab my whole hair and just put it in a bun. But now it's like just, you know, get up and go, you know, like, you don't really have to do much.
That's very nice.
Yes.
So tell me, you've been an activist for a while. I'm wondering if you can talk about how being an activist has changed over the last couple of years. I imagine that as little as 5 years ago, you were still having to explain to people what transgender meant.
You know, I think... the movement, you know, from the beginning, it has been definitely a constant struggle, right? Like, we have sort of, like, right now, we are in a pivotal moment, you know, to where we as a community are being recognized to some degree, particularly in media, right? Like, but the reality is that, you know, we as trans people continue to face extreme social issues, right? You know, like, trans people are not able to obtain jobs, you know, like, just basic needs, you know, housing, for instance, you know, education, like, all of those things, right? Like, things that we already know are still there, you know, and so the struggle is real, and, you know, we are constantly, you know, in this uphill battle.
Yeah, and the struggle, too, that gets me is that, like, trans women are being, like, murdered on the streets, but they're also they're taking their own lives. Like, the suicide rates are staggering.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, I mean, through the work that we do, I mean, just yesterday, I had someone that I was talking to who is homeless, and who, you know, she's so smart. She's 23. She's done, like, public relations work. You know, so she's, like, her intelligence is, like, superb. Yet, because she decided to transition, she's not able to have a job. And therefore, she's homeless now. And because of that, she has to use drugs in order to stay away so that she doesn't have to sleep on the streets. And then when she has slept on the streets, she has been robbed. Like, people have taken her stuff. So this is, like, issues that, you know, are, like, right there. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, this year we have had 23, you know, cases that have been documented, right, that of trans women who have been murdered. But then, you know, there are possibly more that are not documented. And so, but this is the constant struggle that we have to face.
Right. Now, is that what kind of part of what led you to create the Trans Latino Coalition?
That's definitely one of the issues. The Trans Latino Coalition started in 2009 as, you know, for us to really address the needs and issues of trans Latina immigrant individuals who live in this country. So we are a national organization, but last year in 2015, everybody came together and we decided that in order for us to empower and uplift the experiences and lives of trans people, that we needed to do direct service provision. And so right now, we're building the Center for Violence Prevention and Transgender Wellness, and we're addressing both the advocacy, which leads into changing the structures that continue to oppress us, but also the direct community empowerment and leadership development that we need to have in order to develop the next, you know, where the next wave of leaders.
Wow. And so that's been around since 2009?
We started in 2009, and we have representation in 11 different states. So we have 7 organized chapters.
That's huge.
Yeah.
And is it Latin immigrants specifically?
Well, no. Last year, when we met, we changed, we took off immigrants, and we're focusing for the next 5 years, focusing specifically on trans Latinos around the country. But our vision is for us to be an organization that provides resources and empowers the trans community as a whole.
Yeah. I read the 5-year plan. It's on the website.
Yes.
I didn't realize what a big scope it is, from legislation all the way down to just individual lives of, like, HIV care and helping people get jobs. It's very ambitious and necessary.
Yes. And you know, I, as an individual, you know, that's one of the things that I have taken on personally, right? But also, as an organization, you know, this is something that we have taken on and that we are actually doing. Since we started in January of this year, providing direct services, we have, you know, grown. We have 3 staff right now. We just got notice that we got another grant, and we're going to have another staff. We're focusing on economic development, and, you know, we're focusing on providing emergency supportive services to people. We have a program that is an HIV prevention strategy that is funded through the Elton John Foundation, and we provide trans people who are getting released from immigration detention centers and incarceration emergency supportive services. We give them rental assistance, we give them food vouchers, and we give them transportation vouchers, and we have a case manager that connects them with other existing services.
Wow. So how do people know that you exist? Like, are you seeking them out, or do they find you?
They're finding us. I mean, you know, again, our first program was providing emergency supportive services to trans people who are getting released from incarceration or immigration detention centers. And, you know, we're a small community. Word gets around, like, pretty quick. And so far, we have in our caseload 27 individuals that we have served so far since January to today. But, you know, one of the things that we have found and that we continue to see is, like, okay, we are supporting people, like, providing emergency supportive services, but we want to connect them with jobs. And for trans people who are getting released from immigration detention centers, some of them, because of the advocacy that we have done also to get them released, they're sort of like in limbo. So they don't have, you know, they don't have papers to work, they don't have a social security number, they don't have, you know, a way to get an ID. So it's getting difficult to place them into workforce development. So that's one of the issues that we're seeing. we're also seeing that, you know, when we have to place them like in emergency shelters, you know, we're not finding sensitive places to where we can place them. Unfortunately, there's not a place, you know, for us to go to. There is the LGBT center, and they have a program there, but it's specifically for youth ages, you know, up to 24 years old. And so, and even though there's that, there's also a high demand for that. And so for people who are of trans experience, who are above 24 years old, there's nowhere else for us to go. So
you mentioned before, someone who's a homeless, was that a friend or someone you're working with?
Actually have a couple of friends who are struggling and we're trying to place with community housing.
So there's not a like a trans exclusive or like LGBTQ exclusive like homeless shelter.
With the exception of the LGBT center, there's none.
For over 18. Wow. I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. But we are on the task of building that.
Really?
Yes. We are going to make it happen. And one of the things that, you know, is happening, I mean, I know that a lot happens and I get involved in a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But one of the things that are happening is that right now we're actually advocating for the decriminalization of trans people who are doing sex work. Because one of the things that happened recently is that LAPD has set up to do like raids to arrest trans people who are doing sex work. And, you know, they reach out to community organizations to go and do outreach to those people that have arrest. But then yet there's no services to connect them to. So it's a larger issue that we're definitely addressing. In fact, we have sent a letter to the mayor. We have sent a letter to Mitchell Farrell, who is the council member for that district. And we also, the letter was also sent to the police commission and several organizations that we are organizing to address that. And one of our demands is for the city to intentionally invest into the livelihood of trans people.
Wow. How far out do you think that would be to like build a shelter? Like 5 years or like more? More.
No, I mean, this is an emergency thing. You know, I think we need to call it what it is. We as a community are in a state of emergency, and we need for our elected officials that instead of criminalizing us and putting us in jail, that they actually need to invest in the livelihood of trans people. We need to be able to obtain the basic needs, right? Like we need housing, we need jobs, we need, we need to be able to go to school, we need to be able to learn things if we don't have the skills. And so I think those things need to be addressed immediately.
We're talking about like obviously a lot of struggles. When you're I don't want to like generalize, but it's when we're talking about like homelessness and job security, how do you present the future in a realistic way to people you're working with without just making it seem dismal? Like how do you, like, you know?
Well, I mean,
I don't want to phrase that in like an offensive way, but like you need to be realistic. But how do you still like find hope there when we're dealing with such basic needs that need to be met?
You know, a lot of times what I often use, you know, in the community, it's my own personal experience, right? I am one who has overcome all of those things. You know, when I first got to Los Angeles, to Hollywood, I was 19 years old. And I was homeless, and I was a sex worker. I was using drugs. I had been part of a prison industrial complex. You know, I have, like, whatever you can think of, I've lived it and survived it, right? And so I put myself as hope, you know, to the community, and I let them know that, yes, we are in this moment right now, but, you know, if we work together, if we stick together, and if we do what we need to do, we can get to the other side. And I know that my experience is not the experience of everybody, but my experience is similar to many people.
Right.
And so that's how, you know, and we do whatever we have to do, and we have been doing it for, you know, for many years. The only difference now is that we're actually are organizing to demand resources to be allocated and for our lives to be validated.
Absolutely. You got to America at 19, you said?
No. I got to the United States when I was 17.
17.
But I got to Los Angeles when I was 19.
Oh, I see. When did you become an activist?
It's been like, I guess you could say my career has been sort of like short. Again, my previous life was, you know, like I got clean and I got into a treatment center and I got all of that after I was, you know, 32 years old, when I was 32 years old. So it's only been like 15 years that I've been actively nonstop advocating and just, you know.
Because you had to like get your own life figured out first. Yeah. Yes.
But as I was doing that, I was also doing that work. So wow. I was, you know, getting my life together, but I had sort of like a more clear mind and I could see things the way they were. And so it was that, but I was also seeing my friends that I was, you know, in the corner with, you know, just a few months before, being attacked, being murdered, being, you know, dragged from cars, like being chased, you know. And so, you know, like I was seeing it with a more clear mind. But one of the things that sort of like really marked my advocacy and my activism was the murder of Gwen Araujo, which happened in 2002. I'm not sure if you're familiar.
I'm not.
Yeah. Gwen Araujo was a young trans woman who was Latina in Newark, California, and she was brutally murdered by four individuals. And so that obviously resonated with me. It wasn't just that she was murdered, but it was the way she was murdered. And so for me, that was sort of like sparked something in me. And from there, sort of like, you know, it wasn't that just, it was just my strength, but it was also my rage, you know. And again, my own personal experiences, the experience that I was seeing with my friends, and, you know, being that I had survived all of those things, sort of like, you know, opened my mind to know and understand that I was privileged. And that I needed to do something about it. That it was time for me to sort of like, you know, what they say, like pay it forward.
Right? Yeah. You have been through so much. I think that we're very lucky that you are open about it and able to, like, to use your own story to like help others.
I, you know, there's a movie about me. So in, it's called Transvisible, right? Like yeah. there's no shame about, you know, who I am. I own what I've done and I have, you know, pay my dues, right? Like I was, you know, incarcerated, you know, but I also understand now I'm able to see how social factors influence for us to be where we are and to do the things that we have to do.
Right. And I think that's like a great point that I like want to get across to other people is that, trans people are not at risk of homelessness or losing their jobs or of suicidal thoughts and behaviors because of biological factors. It's the environment and like the stigmas and the stress. And it's like the onus is on us, you know, like creating that environment.
Totally. And, you know, I think, you know, it's important to understand that, you know, that gender is a social construct, right? And so we have, you know, for centuries have sort of like formed this notion of, you know, it's either or, right? But historically, there has been people who are, you know, gender nonconforming. It's just that, you know, our society and the violence, the institutional violence that we have experienced, particularly people of color, right, is what has translated for us to be criminalized simply for being who we are.
Right. You know, I have a friend who is intelligent and not a bigot, and they just thought that RuPaul was transgender. So I don't know where people learn about this, if they don't know someone who's trans or don't hear about it in schools, which is rare. I don't know where we learn about it.
Well, I mean, right now, and, you know, in the era that we are right now, right, this is an there's an amazing place that is called YouTube.
Right? I have heard of it.
So, you know, like, you could find out and learn about anything in YouTube. You know,
that's a great actionable thing that people can do.
Totally.
Because it's not people who are like aggressively anti-trans. They just simply don't know.
Right. And there's different ways, you know. And again, you know, unfortunately, like, the media has contributed a lot for us to be where we are in terms of, like, both in the past for people attack us, right, simply for who we are. But also, you know, to bring visibility to our community. And I think it's also important for us to highlight that with visibility, there's also the criminality has increased against us. And we can see that through, you know, different legislation that is passing against us, that, you know, how we constantly get profiled, how we, you know, we constantly get, you know, discriminated, you know, when we're simply trying to get a job. So, like, all of those things obviously contribute for us to be where we are within our society.
Yeah. Yeah, California has some of the most trans-inclusive laws in the country. On the whole, do you feel safe living in L.A.?
You know, it's really unpredictable, you know, because the life of a trans woman of color really is, you know, we're living day by day, right? So when you're at your home, if you have a home, then you could say that you're safe. But when we walk out of our homes, oftentimes we are someone who have a target on us, right? And I mean, even though I am privileged and I am empowered, you know, last year I was a victim of a hate crime, you know, and so it's, we are all exposed to the violence, you know, if you're not sort of like the standard, you know, that people think what is supposed to be beautiful or a woman, for instance, or even a man, if you're not masculine enough, right, like, you could be attacked. If you're not feminine enough, you could be attacked. But one of the reasons is because for us as trans women, I think, and this is obviously my own analogy, right, is that because we have left the privilege of manhood, that, you know, that speaks to the masculinity of other men. And so, therefore, we get prone to be attacked. And I don't know if that makes sense to you.
Oh, no, it does make sense. I was just processing it. That's fascinating. Because often, I mean, I think, too, about how some of the most prominent trans people today are trans women of color. The Janet Mocks and Laverne Coxes. And I think that's such an interesting dichotomy, since they're also the most marginalized group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But also, I think it's important that we also acknowledge that, you know, not all of us and are not all of our experiences are not captured, right? Like, unfortunately, you know, some of us do have the privilege to be in the eye of the media, you know, or that we get recognized, you know, more than others. But unfortunately, that lived experiences that, you know, people or the common people, how we want to say, are not highlighted as they should.
Well, I just completely agree, and I have to think that Janet Mock and Laverne Cox are such, like, classically gorgeous women. I think that almost the culture needed, like, it's a pretty privilege. They needed someone pretty to say, like, oh, okay, we can accept these people, for then to make it okay for other people.
I mean, I think it's the way the media works.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, like, the images that you portrayed is that sort of like the images that, you know, are going to be popular, are going to be sold, right? But I mean, I don't want to in any way minimize, you know, the amazing work that Laverne Cox and Janet Mock have been doing.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, because I love them and they're my dear friends. And, you know, and they have definitely brought visibility to our community. In a way that has never been done before, right? And so I think that's amazing, but again, at the same time, it's also important that we understand that violence has also increased with that.
Yeah. In your advocacy over the last 15 years-ish, is there, like, one or two things you're most proud of?
Oh, my goodness. I can definitely name one or two, but I don't want to just single specific moments because they're having so many things that have, you know, that have in many different ways fed my soul.
Yeah.
You know, but
Well, tell me one and we'll frame it as a moment you're proud of, not the most proud of. Just a moment.
A moment. A most, I guess, recent accomplishment that I have gotten is that well, there have been several since then, but in last June and June of this year, I had the opportunity to share stage with Vice President Biden at a national conference, and this was it was called the State of Women Conference, which is a national conference that was put by the White House, and to be invited to be one of the keynote speakers at a women's conference, to be acknowledged as a woman. Not only that, but also sharing stage with the Vice President, it's huge, right? As someone who has, you know, and I also have been invited to the White House twice, but as someone who has come from, and this is one of my talks that I'm going to do after, from the Big House to the White House.
What's the first word? The what house?
From the Big House to the White House, right?
Yeah.
So, like, someone who has been on the streets, has gone to prison, and, you know, been a drug addict, has been able to, like, overcome those things, and then being acknowledged and you know, being invited to the White House is huge.
Yeah. And as an immigrant, too.
Totally. All of that.
Yeah.
Trans, immigrant, all of those things. All those intersections are me.
That's amazing that also that they're acknowledging immigrants as... I mean, obviously our country is built on immigrants. I'm like the children of them. But to say like, yes, you're a part of our culture today, not just like your kids and the people you help, but like right now. Mm-hmm. What did you talk about at the White House in your speech?
I talked about... And it's really... I mean, I don't want to say it's funny, but it was in some ways timely because it was the Monday after the Orlando incident. So,
wow.
Yeah. So for me, it was a moment to sort of like grieve, but grieving in a moment of empowerment. And so I, you know, started my speech by asking people to, instead of giving a moment of silence, to give a moment of power and to send, you know, love to Orlando. And, you know, so we just scream and clap, and it was like very powerful. But it was also framing that issue of, you know, institutional violence and really calling out the issue of our government, acknowledging trans people, the existence of trans people, and what we need to do to change that. So it was framed around that, really.
Wow. That's powerful.
I know that they taped it, but I need to ask to see if they can, I can, you know. But I got like so many compliments afterwards.
Wow.
Yeah, that, you know, that my speech really moved people.
Wow. You're saying moment of power. Are you, it made me think, are you a spiritual person?
I am. You know, I get my spirituality or the fulfillment of my soul in different ways. But twice a year I take time off. And I seclude myself and I write and I think and I plan, you know.
Where do you go? Do you leave town or are you in your home?
I've done both. For the last couple of years, I've been sort of like learning to go out of state or somewhere, you know, where I can seclude myself, and not necessarily out of state, but somewhere where I can be alone. Like this past July, I was in Oregon. I went to Oregon to some hot springs and, you know, up in the mountains, and it was really great.
Oh, I love that.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. You do that twice a year. You take these time
yes.
off.
Mm-hmm.
What is your self care like though on like a more like daily basis?
Well, I get massages every 2 weeks.
Oh, Bambi. I like that.
Yes. I mean, that's what I need to do for me to take care of myself. That's, I think, for the most part, what I do. I obviously, you know, every night I do like a self-inventory, you know, so I do that. I also, you know, ask my higher power to guide me through the day. So when I wake up in the morning, the first thing that I do, I drink water. And, you know, I ask my higher power to guide me and to, you know, to guide my words and to guide my actions and to guide whatever I'm going to do and to put the people that needs to be put in front of me, to, if I need to help, to help, and whatever it is, right? So that's sort of like the rigorous things that I do every day that I don't skip.
Wow. Well, I think that's a great place to leave it. Thank you for this.
Of course. No, thank you.
Absolutely. If people wanted to find out more about you, should we send them to your website, social media? What do you prefer?
I mean, all of the above. you know, I'm very privileged that I do have a website. So it's BambiSalcedo.com. Or, you know, I'm in social media. Also, people can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all of those, Snapshot, you know.
All the above. Awesome. And I'm at Twitter at JeffMasters1. And you can find all of our previous interviews on iTunes and YouTube. And of course, we have to ask you to leave a comment. Please do that and tell all of your friends. We'll see you next week. Goodbye.
From executive producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire AfterBuzz TV staff, we would like to thank you for listening to the AfterBuzz TV Network. To watch or listen to other after shows and post comments or questions, be sure to visit AfterBuzzTV.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of AfterBuzz TV.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.